I'm Eric Zorn, an op-ed columnist from the Tribune. Sitting across from me is Mary Schmeek, Metro columnist from the Tribune. We're sitting in for Bill and Wendy today, who are off doing God knows what. I predict, Mary, that you will be very interested in this next segment, this next guest we have. On the phone with us is Gary Saul Morrison. He is the co-author of The Fabulous Future, America and the World in 2040, a book just published by Northwestern University Press. Dr. Morrison, are you there?
I'm here. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to talk to you.
Do you mind if we call you Gary?
Absolutely. Please do.
Thank you.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way, I am fascinated by this book, the concept for it. And if you could take us back, this is based on something that was published in 1955 by Fortune magazine, which was The Fabulous Future, America and the World in 1980. Is that right?
Yes, except it was then. It was just America in 1980. They acted as if America were the world back then. And I guess it was closer to being it economically and in terms of politics. That seems less the case right now, so that's why the difference of the change in title.
You say that's why the change in title, so you put the word fabulous in there to provoke people because people...
We put the phrase and the world. It used to be just America in 25 years.
Focus
America and the world in 25 years. And their title was The Fabulous Future. Ours is The Fabulous Future?
Well, let's
less optimistic.
Let's take a look at this 1955 effort, their effort was to look at the year 25 years into the future, and yours is an effort to look at the year 25 years from now. How did they do back in 1955? How would you assess their predictive powers?
Well, it's really interesting because here are a lot of the smartest people in the world, you know, Adlai Stevenson, Earl Warren, John von Neumann, who, you know, invented game theory and cybernetics and was a prominent physicist, and they did a terrible job. they thought that in 25 years we wouldn't need any fossil fuels because everything would be done by nuclear power. Nuclear power was then the utopia that everybody looked to. They thought we'd have, you know, we'd all be flying around in private helicopters, you know, powered by, you know, little nuclear engines.
So were they really predicting or just hoping?
No, this was a book of predictions. They really thought this would be the case. In fact, some of them gave these predictions and said that there is no way this will not happen. It's absolutely certain. Some of them were a little more modest than that. But they were very confident that this was going to be the case. I mean, the famous phrase from the book is that power will be too cheap to meter. It will be as free as the unmetered air. You know.
What did they get right?
What did they get right? Well, they did predict correctly that there'd be a cure for polio. Of course, that wasn't very far away at the time. That was supposed to happen, you know, the next year. So I guess it wasn't much of a prediction. They did predict a lot of, you know, they saw that the pace of science and technology would accelerate, and they were certainly right about that. But what they didn't imagine was that it would happen in unforeseen ways. They drew straight lines from current events. That's why, you know, you'd have things like, we're going to deliver mail by intercontinental missile. If you think about that, it's sort of... they haven't seen the information revolution. And this is amazing because John von Neumann, who was in the volume, basically was the founder of the information revolution. But even he didn't foresee it, you know. He saw, you know, computers as leading to calculators. We'd all have pocket calculators. That turned out to be right. But he didn't foresee all the other uses that it would have, you know. The internet, the personal computer on your desktop, which seems so much in the past.
Yeah, it seems like the combination of that you're talking about are predictions that are far too modest. You know, like, oh, we all have little things that do calculations, and things that are just absurdly optimistic. That there's this whole range of predictions that people make, right?
Yes, they thought we'd have a world government which would ensure peace and democracy. First of all, the idea of a world government was absurd. Then, second of all, that it would be basically imposing sort of American values on the world, because what else could anybody believe in? You know.
So how did you go about making your predictions for Fabulous 2040 to increase the odds that you'd be right?
Well, it's not they didn't do it. Right? I mean, you did the same thing. You assembled all these experts also, right?
Yes, although the difference is that they just got smart people to talk about whatever they wanted to. We got people to talk about, they were restricted to talking about what they were experts in. That was under the assumption that even geniuses, when they stray out of their field, tend to turn into idiots. You know, they are just as confident, let's say, they're technologists in their political predictions as they are in their technological ones. But in fact, they don't really have any special expertise there. So we ask them to just do what they are experts in.
What is the appeal of making predictions like this? Mary and I were talking before the break about, Mary was sort of saying that this is just entertainment. It's just silliness.
Well, I was talking about political predictions.
But, you know, other predictions too. Is it, you know, just entertainment? Just...
Well, if you can get anything right, and not just, you know, what happens, but what could happen, you can guard against dangers. Try to think about, you know, you can't really make any intelligent decisions about anything unless you're making predictions. Every decision involves a prediction as to what is likely to happen. You know, you can't really plan for your retirement without deciding how to invest, and that depends on what you think is likely to happen. You know, you can't plan your future job career without some sense of, you know, what the field is going to look like at some point. Everything we do involves predictions. So if we can get them better, we buy insurance because there are dangers that could happen, even if they're unlikely to. But you can't insure against everything. You have to have some sense that they... how likely they would be.
Can you stick around with us over the break? I'd like to hear what people are predicting for 2040, so we can talk about what going forward, what we think we can look for. This is Eric Zorn for the Tribune, and that's Mary Schmeek, and on the line with us is Gary Saul Morrison. He's co-author with Northwestern University President Morton Shapiro of The Fabulous Future, America and the World in 2040, wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Radio 720 WGN. I'm Mary Schmeek, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, sitting here with Eric Zorn, also a columnist for the Tribune. And we are talking with Gary Saul Morrison, Northwestern Professor of Arts and Humanities, who has co-written a book, The Fabulous Future, America and the World in 2040. Gary, before we get back to your predictions or the predictions of the people in your book, just tell us how you got from being a professor of arts and humanities with specialties in Russian and European ideas and literature to your fascination with predictions.
Well, it came out of a course that President Shapiro and I do together on choices and decisions and how they're made. And it's an interdisciplinary course. We cover, you know, he's an economist specializing in higher education. I practice philosophy, got a license, and do Russian literature. And we set the class up to argue about one issue after another, usually from the perspective of our two respective disciplines. And so one of the books we assigned in this class was the original Fabulous Future. And some of the students suggested that it would be a good idea to update it and see, you know, what people are predicting now. Because one of the ideas we had is that, you know, even if the predictions are wrong, they show what it felt like to live at a certain time.
Exactly.
We can understand what it felt like to be in 1955 by what they anticipated.
Right.
Exactly.
And that would be true of us, too.
Yes, I think that's exactly true. I think that predictions have this value in that they tell you about the time that you're in as much as they tell you about, I mean, what you probably learn from these predictions now is they tell you a lot about 2015 and where people are as opposed to what things are really going to be like in 2040.
Like the Jetsons.
I think so, yeah.
And I love the idea of practicing philosophy without a license. Who doesn't do that? It sounds like a great course. It makes me want to go back to college. But let's get to these predictions. What are people saying they think life is going to be like? Who are these experts and what are they saying?
Well, we have a couple of economists. You know, Professor Gore Gordon, who's actually at Northwestern, is predicting that the growth, economic days of heady economic growth are over. Things are just not going to grow very much, and he has some reasons for that. Well, President Shapiro himself is talking about how higher education will change, and he tends to be rather optimistic about its directions. And
well, such as what? What's going to be good about higher education? Maybe better about higher education?
Well, a lot of people are concerned that adjunct professors are doing a lot more of the teaching. And he's actually done a study about how well they teach, trying to find out, do adjunct full-time professors, but not on the tenure-track system, teach worse, better, or the same as professors on the tenure-track system? And he found out that, at least in basic courses, they teach better.
Well, good for the students, but not necessarily for the professors.
They need to
right?
get paid more than President
That's
Shapiro.
True. Well, but actually, I mean, part of his point is that since they do a better job and we're relying on them more and more, we ought to treat them better. That's part of his point here.
Does he talk at all about the impact of these online courses, the MOOCs, so-called, massive online courses? I mean, is this going to change higher education in a big way?
Well, we both had pretty strong feelings about that. Basically, you know, it might provide higher education for people who couldn't have it otherwise, but the idea that it's going to replace the college experience is, you know, is just absurd. And you can see that even the institutions, he points out, that sponsor MOOCs, you know, that give these MOOC courses, they don't give the same credit for them as they would for courses taken on their own campus to their own students.
Does
they
he
predict? Really believe what they're saying.
Does he predict the cost curve will change? Because as someone who's sending off two freshmen to college this year, I'm a little concerned about that.
Yes. Well, of course, I have a freshman in college, too. He likes to point out that it's somewhat misleading to just talk about the advertised sticker price, because almost nobody actually pays that. I think the figure is about 14% of the people pay that. So the real question is, what do people actually pay after, you know, scholarships and both for, you know, need and merit? And that tends to be a lot less. So the question becomes a lot more complicated than it looks like in the sensationalist press.
Now, I'm sorry, finish that thought.
No, that's finished.
Now, not all of your predictions are about education. So
there's just one essay. That,
yeah, so tell us some other areas that you've made predictions in.
Well, we have Eileen Crimmins, who's an expert on, aging, and she predicts that although lifespans will be extended, useful lifespans will be extended a lot more slowly, which means that we're facing much longer periods of people who are alive but can't do very much or in nursing homes, and we're not really taking that into account.
This is what puts the question mark in fabulous, right?
I'm sorry? This is less than fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, you know, we have Robert Gallucci in the volume. He used to head the MacArthur Foundation, and he was one of our negotiators with North Korea. He makes predictions of a number of black swans that are events that are unlikely to happen, but just likely enough that you want to consider them. And one of the particularly startling ones is a nuclear terrorist attack that would take place in four different U.S. cities at once. The point being, if you can do one, four at once is particularly demoralizing. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, easily, he thinks, could happen. If unlikely, it's not extremely unlikely.
What did if I can just go back in 1955, that was not too long after the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Was there any prediction then about any thought that we could have possibly gotten through another 25 years without a nuclear explosion?
People didn't seem to think there was going to be one. They tend to be rather optimistic, in spite of the fact that they all were extremely conscious of, you know, the Cold War. But they seem to think that was the you know, the Cold War would continue, but they seem to have a relatively optimistic view of what it means wouldn't lead to.
Go ahead.
It easily could have. You know, there just a few years later, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, you know, we were at a hair's breadth of having a nuclear war.
What about technology? What sort of technological developments are people seeing for the next, for 2040?
Well, a lot of them, like we have Arianna Huffington in the volume, have to do with, you know, information and how it's going to be used. A lot of has to do with, you know, new materials and nanotechnology. Mark Ratner, who's in our volume, a Northwestern chemist, predicts that we are going to be able to read people's minds from without, which I find incredibly scary.
I'm skeptical of that, I have to say.
I hope you're right. Because we also have in the volume a civil libertarian, Wendy Kaminer, who outlines all the ways in which our civil liberties have been restricted already, in which privacy is almost impossible, and predicts basically the end of any privacy or free speech within
It's just getting more fabulous by the minute.
Well, we're not. That's why it's a fabulous future. Question mark. You know, it's, you know, that says a lot about the difference between what the world, you know, felt like then and felt like now. You'd think that after World War II and facing the Cold War, they would have been more pessimistic. But in fact, they were much more optimistic.
Why do you think that is? We're going to have to bump over to the next segment here in a moment, right?
Yeah.
Well, it could be because, you know, America, after World War II, was overwhelmingly the dominant power, much more than it's ever been since. So it looked like we could shape the world in our image, and we knew how to do that. And then, in spite of, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it still looked like technology would only do good things for you. You know, that was now, I think, people are worried that anything that can help us can hurt us, that all these things that provide us with, you know, much better services can also spy on us a lot more effectively, whether, you know, it's by government or corporations. That doesn't seem like terribly appealing. We're much more aware of the downside of technology than they were then.
But this sounds like such a fascinating, vital book. The title is The Fabulous Future, America and the World in 2040. On the line with us has been Gary Saul Morrison. He's the co-author of that book. It's published by Northwestern University Press. Everyone should go out and buy this and compare their predictions to the experts. Thanks for being on with us.
Thank you, Gary. It was fascinating.
We got a break for news now. I'm Eric Zorn. This is Mary Schmeek across the table, and we'll be right back.